Because they need help.
Yeah, why did they need help?
Because we got an earthquake.
And it damaged everything in the country.
You know what's happening now?
I think they're trying to help Haiti, like, to get money.
And they're getting band-aids and stuff.
That's very beautiful.
We're going to come on news.
Yeah. Yeah, I work at WBAI.
Yeah.
Yeah, you heard of it? You raised a lot of money?
Yep. Over $11,000.
That's wonderful.
I donated money. I donated $10 to Haiti.
Why'd you do that?
So Haiti can have more fortunate.
Today we're helping raise money for Partners in Health, which is an organization that helps Haiti. And they've been there for 20 years.
What are the groups?
The New Settlement After School Program at PS 64. Together as an organization, we raised over $11,000 for the fund. And we have almost about 300 students within our after school program here with us.
Who sont les enfants?
You have been listening to The Sweet Science of Racism in Haiti, an Earthwatch documentary special produced for WBAI Pacifica Radio by Robert Knight.
How does one fashion a book of resistance? A book of truth in an empire of falsehood, or a book of rectitude in an empire of vicious lies? How does one do this right in front of the enemy? Not through the old-fashioned ways of writing while you're in the bathroom, but how does one do that in a truly future technological state? Is it possible for freedom and independence to rise in new ways under new conditions? That is, will new tyrannies abolish these protests? Or will there be new responses by the spirit that we can't anticipate? Those are the words of Philip K. Dick. For some more, stay tuned. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, normally I would play the second half of the piece called The Space Fleet by Peter Schickley, which has served as the theme music for this show, but we have a very tight show with a great deal of agenda to deal with this morning. And the first thing I want to do, bringing up a little bit of other music, is to get an announcement out of the way. so that we can move on. But it's an important announcement. The person that you are hearing singing and playing in the background is Pan Morrigan. And I had her scheduled to perform with writer Andrea Hairston at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings in February, whatever the first Thursday in February was. Usually we go first Tuesdays, but to accommodate their schedule, we went for the Thursday. Now, as luck would have it, there was, of course, snow and, more importantly, ice. It wasn't that they were snowed in. It's that they were iced out. Coming down from Massachusetts, the weather was just horrific, and we didn't want to worry about travel conditions from Massachusetts to New York. So we postponed. And now we know that the reading that was originally scheduled for early February will occur this coming Sunday, March 6th, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Doors opening at 1:30. Admission is free. And Andrea Hairston is an amazing, wonderful writer. She has a new novel out, which is part of what has spawned this particular tour. The novel entitled Redwood and Wildfire, published by Aqueduct Press. Boy, do I hope that I don't start stumbling over my words for the next 90 minutes. Anyway, she is, I would say, one of the preeminent black writers of speculative fiction today. Her first novel, Mindscape, came out in 2006 and won the Carl Brandon Parallax Award, was shortlisted for the Philip K. Dick Award. Ooh, there's that name again. And the Tiptree Award. Griots of the Galaxy, a short story appeared in So Long Been Dreaming, Postcolonial Visions of the Future, edited by the equally wonderful and amazing Nalo Hopkinson and Upender Meehan. So Andrea will be reading this Sunday and performing with her the person you are hearing in the background, Pan Morrigan, award-winning vocalist, songwriter, composer, multi-instrumentalist, and producer, known for her silvery, wide-ranging voice and passionate stage presence. Wow, you know, is that all true? So, I mean, you're hearing it. That tells you as much as you need to know about that, other than admission is free. We do ask for donations at the door, but don't let that stop you coming. Come anyway. It'll just be me at the door, and you say, nah, thanks, I can't afford it. It just goes to buy drinks and dinner and offset expenses for the performers. We'll make it, don't worry. So come no matter what. And as I say, admission is free. It occurs at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is at, oh, great, I actually put out a press release and I didn't put the address up top. Well, it is beneath, but I know it by heart. It's 138 Sullivan Street, right? Oh, you all probably knew that already because there are so many cool events there. So, 138 Sullivan Street, this Sunday, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Andrea Hairston, Pan Morrigan. I hope to see you there. For more information, go to my website at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, like the radio show that you are listening to, Hour of the Wolf. Alrighty, let's see. Let's hear the end of the song. There we go. Pan Morrigan. That, by the way, I should mention, is from her brand new album called Wild Blue. And actually, I got this. Thank you, Alma Patterson. She gave it to me as a gift during the seasonal holidays of December. Okay. By now, it is Thursday, March 3rd. But until an hour and 37 minutes ago, it was March 2nd, the 29th anniversary of the death of Philip Kindred Dick. And a person who, well, I don't know if he'd be rolling over in his grave, if he is rolling over in his grave, over every time you turn around, there's another movie based on his work. What makes me roll over, grave or not, are that these movies are often poor frequently have little to do with the source material from which they are derived. But ongoing and ongoing. In fact, if you take a look at words about the new movie, which is called The Adjustment Bureau. No, I have not seen it. Which is, quote, loosely based. At least they do admit loosely based on a short story called The Adjustment Team, or just Adjustment Team. You know, there's not much connection between them. But let's go through some of the history of some of the adaptations of Philip K. Dick. Well, of course, in radio, there were at least two episodes of between X-1 and Dimension X. There was the Colony and the Defenders. There was a Twilight Zone starring George Peppard, based on the Electric Ant. Then there was a, let me take a look here. I've got IMDb up. I can see they're actually missing. They don't have the Twilight Zone, for example. Then there was a movie called Blade Runner, based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the same source material as the play that we discussed when on this very second episode of this program, when it was moved into this time slot just a few months ago. Then, let's see, Total Recall, loosely based on We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. Now, one of my favorite movies from 1992, Barjo, B-A-R-J-O. Bet you never heard of that one. It's a French film based on the novel and very, very closely based on the novel Confessions of a Crap Artist. And there's, let's see, Screamers, based on the short story Second Variety. TV series Total Recall, a TV movie Total Recall 2070, Imposter, based on the short story The Imposter, Minority Report by Spielberg, directed by Spielberg, based on short story called The Minority Report. And while I thought that was a decent movie, it had very little to do with the short story that Philip Dick wrote, although it really did capture the Philip K. Dick universe. It just wasn't a story he ever wrote. Then there was Paycheck, Scanner Darkly. Now, there was a decent movie, truly, truly based on Philip K. Dick, directed by Richard Linklater, available on DVD, wonderful rotoscope animation, and just a fascinating film. There was Screamers. Now, according to this, there was a movie which I have not seen called Radio Free Albemuth, which actually is a novel I liked quite a bit. I wonder what they have done with it. It opens, by the way, the novel opens at Pacifica Radio in the 1950s, no less, at KPFA, where Philip K. Dick was a record librarian, as a matter of fact, in that era, in the late 50s. Now, of course, the Adjustment Bureau opened last week, and theoretically a TV miniseries opening, premiering later this year in England, based on what is arguably Philip K. Dick's finest novel, The Man in the High Castle. Now, some of these things have been getting better. I didn't mention, by the way, I saw a fabulous play done by the Mabu Mines, based on Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. But, you know, there's still nothing like reading Philip K. Dick. And if I told you that today's show has a premise, has a message, I would put it in three words. Read the books. Let's expand that. Read the books by Philip K. Dick. And by the way, don't ignore the short stories. It's not a mistake that a lot of these movies are actually based on short stories. Some of them, in fact, rather obscure short stories. And I, being a fan of all things short stories, not to say I don't like the novels, but a lot of his novels, by the way, yeah, they provide great unmined material, and I don't object to the fact that a great science fiction writer, a person of great literary merit, is being turned into cinema and television, albeit often bad cinema and television, or at least sloppy, not having seen the Adjustment Bureau, but I am saddened that still so little other great stuff by so many other great writers remains unmined. And also, I'm not really aware that the books of Phil Dick are doing great as a result. I have the Library of America, very prestigious. They have been churning out a number of short story collections and reprints of novels, mostly overseen by Jonathan Lethem. But those aren't really, you know, moving big time to the general public. I don't know that these are available as ebooks. Which isn't, I'm saying that you have to go get the ebook. What I'm saying is that is a decent indicator of just how easy, just how much of a commercial impact the publishers think it's likely for these works to have. So, again, the urging. Read the books. Read the stories. Or perhaps listen to one of the stories. Let's do that. Dick died young when he was my age. He'd been dead for 3 years. And he was about 54 when he died. I guess I'm about 57 at this point. And as he went through phases. I mean, you can almost talk about Philip K. Dick as, having his reality phase, the what is the essence of the true human being phase, this and that and so forth. And then he went through his religious phase, which is an amazing, insane, wonderful thing. And some of it lucid, some of it complex. And at a certain point, he was starting to go into another phase, not long before he died. About the time, as a matter of fact, that Blade Runner came out. He was on the set of Blade Runner. He was shown around, apparently, by Sean Young. I cannot believe he died 29 years and one day ago, because I remember meeting the guy. And and I remember doing a series of shows at the time that he died, and that's not old. And in fact, unless I'm mistaken, the short story that we're going to look at, called I Hope I Shall Arrive Soon, was not yet in book form at the time of his death. And the thing I was going to bring up is, at the time that he died, I thought he was moving into another phase. And let's call that phase, you know what? This guy can write phase. I mean, he had done amazing things with literature. By the way, he wrote screenplays, none of which were ever produced. One of my favorite novels of his, Ubik, U-B-I-K. Was a screenplay that Dick wrote and was not made into a movie. And I tell you, to this day, that would be a great film. It might take tweaking. It might take, you know, some script doctor to come in and deal with it. But great film. Great film. Not made. Who knows? They're making just about everything that he wrote, so maybe. But for all the stuff that he did, he wasn't necessarily a fabulous master of prose. He knew how to fashion a story. And a lot of the stuff that he wrote merely to be commercial. He was writing mainstream, I'm wiggling my fingers, novels for a while, only to be, because he thought science fiction was a dead end. Only to be told, well, he didn't have the chops for mainstream, and he would often just switch what he was doing in anger for one reason or another. He went back to science fiction. But I think in the early 80s, And I believe the story, I'll look it up, that we're about to look at, is from 82, which is about when he died. I think he was starting to turn into a much finer writer. His themes, well, the themes often involve what is reality, what is the authentic human being, and oh boy, how paranoid can you get when you reveal layers of reality? I think this story takes all of those themes and combines it well, and is, by the way, a good adventure. It is entitled, I Hope I Shall Arrive Soon. After takeoff, the ship routinely monitored the condition of the 60 people sleeping in its cryonic tanks. One malfunction showed, that of person 9. His EEG revealed brain activity. Crap, the ship said to itself. Complex homeostatic devices locked into the circuit feed, and the ship contacted person 9. You are slightly awake, the ship said, utilizing the psychotronic route. There was no point in rousing person 9 to full consciousness. After all, the flight would last a decade. Virtually unconscious, but unfortunately still able to think, person 9 thought, someone is addressing me. He said, where am I located? I don't see anything. You're in faulty cryonic suspension. Then I shouldn't be able to hear you. Faulty, I said. That's the point. You can hear me. Do you know your name? Victor Kemmings. Bring me out of this. We are in flight. Then put me under. Time passed. Just a moment. The ship examined the cryonic mechanisms. It scanned and surveyed, and then it said, I will try. Victor Kemmings, unable to see anything, unaware of his body, found himself still conscious. Lower my temperature, he said. He could not hear his voice. Perhaps he only imagined he spoke. Colors floated toward him and then rushed at him. He liked the colors. It reminded him of a child's paint box, the semi-animated kind, an artificial life form. He had used them in school 200 years ago. I can't put you under, the voice of the ship sounded inside Kemmings' head. The malfunction is too elaborate. I cannot correct it, and I can't repair it. You will be conscious for 10 years. The semi-animated colors rushed toward him, but now they possessed a sinister quality, supplied to him by his own fear. Oh, my God, he said. 10 years. The colors darkened. As Victor Kemmings lay paralyzed, surrounded by dismal flickerings of light, the ship explained to him its strategy. The strategy did not represent a decision on its part. The ship had been programmed to seek the solution in case of a malfunction of this sort. What I will do, the voice of the ship came to him, is feed your sensory stimulation. The peril to you is sensory deprivation. If you are conscious for 10 years without sensory data, your mind will deteriorate. When we reach the LR4 system, you will be a vegetable. Well, what do you intend to feed me? Kemmings said. What do you have in your information storage banks of all the video soap operas of the last century? No, just wake me up and I'll walk around. There is no air in me, the ship said. Nothing for you to eat. No one to talk to since everyone else is under. Kemmings said, I can talk to you. We can play chess. Not for 10 years. Listen to me. I say, I have no food and no air. You must remain as you are. A bad compromise, but one forced on us. You are talking to me now. I have no particular information stored. Here is policy in these situations. I will feed you your own buried memories, emphasizing the pleasant ones. You possess 206 years of memories, and most of them have sunk down in your unconscious. This is a splendid source of sensory data for you to receive. Be of good cheer. This situation which you are in is not unique. It has never happened within my domain before, but I am programmed to deal with it. Relax, and trust me. I will see that you are provided with a world. They should have warned me, Kemmings said, before I agreed to emigrate. Relax, the ship said. He relaxed, but he was terribly frightened. Theoretically, he should have gone under into the successful cryonic suspension, then awakened a moment later at his star of destination, or rather, the planet, the colony planet of that star. Everyone else aboard the ship lay in an unknowing state. He was the exception, as if bad karma had attacked him for obscure reasons. Worst of all, he had to depend totally on the goodwill of the ship. Suppose it elected to feed him monsters. The ship could terrorize him for 10 years, 10 objective years, and undoubtedly more from a subjective standpoint. He was, in effect, totally within the ship's power. Did interstellar ships enjoy such a situation? He knew little about interstellar ships. His field was microbiology. Let me think, he said to himself. My first wife, Martine, the lovely little French girl who wore jeans and a red shirt open at the waist and cooked delicious crepes. I hear, said the ship. So be it. The rushing colors resolved themselves into coherent, stable shapes. A building, a little yellow old house that he had owned when he was 19 years old in Wyoming. Wait, he said in panic. The foundation was bad. It was on a mud sill, and the roof leaked. But he saw the kitchen, and with the table that he had built himself, and he felt glad. You will not know, after a little while, the ship said, that I am feeding you your own buried memories. I haven't thought of that house in a century, he said wonderingly, entranced. He made out his old electric drip coffee pot with a box of paper filters beside it. This is the house where Martine and I lived. Marlene! I'm on the phone, Martine said from the living room. The ship said, I will cut in only when there is an emergency. I will be monitoring you, however, to be sure you are in a satisfactory state. Don't be afraid. Turn down the right rear burner on the stove, Martine called. He could hear her, and yet not see her. He made his way from the kitchen through the dining room and into the living room. At the VF, Martine stood in rapt conversation with her brother. She wore shorts, and she was barefoot. Through the front windows of the living room, he could see the street. A commercial vehicle was trying to park without success. It's a warm day. I ought to turn on the air conditioner. He seated himself on the old sofa as Martine continued her VF conversation, and he found himself gazing at his most cherished possession, a framed poster on the wall above Martine, Gilbert Shelton's Fat Freddy Says drawing in which Freddy Freak sits with his cat on his lap, and Fat Freddy is trying to say speed kills, but he is so wired on speed, he holds in his hand every kind of amphetamine tablet, pill, spancel, and capsule that exists, that he can't say it. And the cat is gritting his teeth and wincing in a mixture of dismay and disgust. The poster is signed by Gilbert Shelton himself. Kemming's best friend Ray Torrance gave it to him and Martine as a wedding present. It is worth thousands. It was signed by the artist back in the 1980s, long before either Victor Kemmings or Martine lived. If we ever run out of money, Kemmings thought to himself, we could sell the poster. It was not a poster. It was the poster. Martine adored it. The fabulous furry freak brothers from the golden age of a long-ago society. No wonder he loved Martine so. She herself loved back, loved the beauties of the world, and treasured and cherished them as she treasured and cherished him. It was a protective love that nourished but did not stifle. It had been her idea to frame the poster. He would have tacked it up on the wall, so stupid was he. Hey, Martine said, off the VF now. What are you thinking? Just that you keep alive what you love, he said. I think that's what you're supposed to do, Martine said. Are you ready for dinner? Open some wine, a red Cabernet. Will an '07 do? He said, standing up. He felt then like taking hold of his wife and hugging her. Either a '07 or a '12, she trotted past him, through the dining room and into the kitchen. Going down into the cellar, he began to search among the bottles, which, of course, lay flat. Musty air and dampness. He liked the smell of the cellar, but then he noticed the redwood planks lying half buried in the dirt, and he thought, I know, I've got to get a concrete slab poured. He forgot about the wine and went over to a far corner where the dirt was piled highest. Bending down, he poked at a board. He poked with a trowel, and then he thought, Where did I get this trowel? I didn't have it a minute ago. The board crumbled against the trowel. The whole house is collapsing here. Well, Christ's sake, I'd better tell Martine. Going back upstairs, the wine forgotten, he started to say to her that the foundations of the house were dangerously decayed. But Martine was nowhere in sight. And nothing cooked on the stove. No pots, no pans. Amazed, he put his hands in the stove and found it cold. What, wasn't she just cooking? He asked himself. Martine? He asked loudly. No response. Except for himself, the house was empty. Empty, he thought, and collapsing. Oh, my God. He seated himself in the kitchen table and felt the chair give slightly under him. It did not give much, but he felt it. He felt the sagging. I'm afraid, he thought. Where did she go? He returned to the living room. Maybe she went next door to borrow some spices or butter or something, he reasoned. Nevertheless, panic now filled him. He looked at the poster. It was unframed, and the edges had been torn. I know she framed it, he thought. He ran across the room to examine it closely. Faded. The artist's signature had faded. He could scarcely make it out. She insisted on framing it in under glare-free, reflection-free glass. But it isn't framed, and it's torn to the most precious thing that we own. Suddenly, he found himself crying. It amazed him, his tears. Martine is gone. The poster is deteriorated. The house is crumbling away. Nothing is cooking on the stove. This is terrible, he thought, and I don't understand it. The ship understood it. The ship had been carefully monitoring Victor Kemming's brainwave patterns, and the ship knew that something had gone wrong. The wave forms showed agitation and pain. I must get him out of this feed circuit, or I will kill him, the ship decided. Where does the flaw lie? Worry dormant in the man, underlying anxieties. Perhaps if I intensify the signal. I will use the same source, but amp up the charge. What has happened is that massive subliminal insecurities have taken possession of him. The fault is not mine, but lies instead in his psychological makeup. I will try an earlier period in his life, the ship decided, before the neurotic anxieties got laid down. In the backyard, Victor scrutinized a bee that had gotten itself trapped in a spider's web. The spider wound up the bee with great care. Well, that's wrong, Victor thought. I'll let the bee loose. Reaching up, he took hold of the encapsulated bee, drew it from the web, and scrutinizing it carefully, began to unwrap it. The bee stung him. It felt like a little patch of flame. Why did it sting me? He wondered. I was letting it go. He went indoors to his mother and told her, but she did not listen. She was watching television. His finger hurt where the bee had stung it, but, more important, he did not understand why the bee would attack its rescuer. Well, I won't do that again, he said to himself. Put some Bactine on it, his mother said at last, roused from watching the TV. He began to cry. It was unfair. It made no sense. He was perplexed and dismayed, and he felt a hatred towards small living things because they were dumb. They didn't have any sense. He left the house, played for a time on his swings, his slide, in his sandbox, and then he went to the garage because he heard a strange flapping, whirring sound, so like a kind of fan. Inside the gloomy garage, he found that a bird was fluttering against the cobwebbed rear window, trying to get out. Below it, the cat, Dorky, leaped and leaped, trying to reach the bird. He picked up the cat. The cat extended its body and its front legs. It extended its jaws and bit into the bird. At once, the cat scrambled down and ran off with a still fluttering bird. Victor ran into the house. Dorky caught a bird, he told his mother. Damn cat. His mother took the broom from the closet in the kitchen and ran outside trying to find Dorky. The cat had concealed itself under the bramble bushes, and she could not reach it with the broom. I'm going to get rid of that cat, his mother said. Now, Victor did not tell her that he had arranged for the cat to catch the bird. He watched in silence as his mother tried to pry Dorky out from her hiding place. Dorky was crunching up the bird. He could hear the sound of breaking bones, small bones. He felt a strange feeling as if he should tell his mother what he had done, yet if he told her, she would punish him. "I won't do that again," he said to himself. His face, he realized, had turned red. What if his mother had figured it out? What if she had some secret way of knowing? Dorky couldn't tell her, and the bird was dead. No one would ever know. He was safe. But he felt bad. That night he could not eat his dinner. Both his parents noticed. They thought he was sick. They took his temperature. He said nothing about what he had done. His mother told his father about Dorky, and they decided to get rid of Dorky. Seated at the table, listening, Victor began to cry. "All right," his father said gently, "we won't get rid of her. It's natural for a cat to catch a bird." The next day he sat playing in his sandbox. Some plants grew up through the sand. He broke them off. Later his mother told him that had been a wrong thing to do. Alone in the backyard, in his sandbox, he sat with a pail of water forming a small mound of wet sand. The sky, which had been blue and clear, became by degrees overcast. A shadow passed over him and he looked up. He sensed a presence around him, something vast that could think. "You are responsible for the death of the bird," the presence thought. He could understand its thoughts. "I know," he said. He wished then that he could die, that he could replace the bird and die for it, leaving it as it had been, fluttering against the cobweb window of the garage. The bird wanted to fly and eat and live, the presence thought. "Yes," he said miserably. "You must never do that again," the presence told him. "I'm sorry," he said, and he wept. This is a very neurotic person, the ship realized. I'm having an awful lot of trouble finding happy memories. There is too much fear in him and too much guilt. He has buried it all, and yet it is still there worrying him like a dog worrying a rag. Where can I go in his memories to find him solace? I must come up with 10 years of memories or his mind will be lost. Perhaps, the ship thought, the error that I'm making is in the area of choice on my part. I should allow him to select his own memories. However, the ship realized, this will allow an element of fantasy to enter. And that is not usually good. Still, I'll try the segment dealing with his first marriage once again, the ship decided. He really loved Martine. Perhaps this time, if I kept the intensity of the memories at a greater level, the entropic factor can be abolished. What happened was a subtle vitiation of the remembered world, a decay of structure. I'm going to try to compensate for that. So be it. "Do you suppose that Gilbert Shelton really signed this?" Martine said. She stood before the poster, her arms folded. She rocked back and forth slightly as if seeking a better perspective in the brightly colored drawing hanging from the living room wall. I mean, it could have been forged by a dealer somewhere along the line, during Shelton's lifetime or after. "There's a letter of authentication," Victor Cummings reminded her. "That's right," she smiled her warm smile. "Ray gave us the letter that goes with it." "But what if the letter is a forgery? What we need is another letter, certifying that the first letter is authentic." Laughing, she walked away from the poster. "Ultimately," Cummings said, "we would have to have Gilbert Shelton here to personally testify that he signed it." "Oh, maybe he wouldn't know. There's that story about the man bringing the Picasso picture to Picasso and asking him if it was authentic. And Picasso immediately signed it and said, 'Now it's authentic.'" She put her arm around Cummings and, standing on tiptoe, kissed him on the cheek. "It's genuine. Ray wouldn't have given us a forgery. He's the leading expert on countercultural art of the 20th century. Do you know that he owns an actual lid of dope? It's preserved under—" "Ray is dead," Victor said. "What?" She gazed at him in astonishment. Do you mean something happened to him since we last—" "He's been dead for 2 years," Cummings said. "I was responsible. I was driving the buzz car. I wasn't cited by the police, but it was my fault." Ray is living on Mars. She stared at him. I know I was responsible. I never told you. I never told anyone. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it. It's just that I saw it flapping against the window and Dorky was trying to reach it. And so I lifted Dorky up and I don't know why, but Dorky grabbed it and... Sit down, Victor. Martine led him to the overstuffed chair and made him seat himself. Something's wrong, she said. I know, he said. Something terrible is wrong. I'm responsible for the taking of a life, a precious life that can never be replaced. I'm sorry. I wish I could make it okay, but I can't. After a pause, Martine said, call Ray. The cat, he said. What cat? There, he pointed, in the poster, on Fat Freddy's lap. That's Dorky. Dorky killed Ray. Silence. The presence told me, Cummings said. It was God. I didn't realize it at the time, but God saw me commit the crime, the murder, and he will never forgive me. His wife stared at him numbly. God sees everything you do. He even sees the falling sparrow, only in this case it didn't fall, it was grabbed. Grabbed out of the air and torn down. God is tearing this house down, which is my body, to pay me back for what I have done. We should have had a building contractor look this house over before we bought it. It's just falling goddamn to pieces. In a year there won't be anything left of it. Don't you believe me? Martine faltered. Watch. Cummings reached his arms up toward the ceiling. He stood and reached. He could not touch the ceiling. He walked to the wall, and then, after a pause, he put his hand through the wall. Martine screamed. The ship aborted the memory retrieval instantly, but the harm had been done. He's integrated his early fears and guilt into one interwoven grid. The ship said to itself, there is no way I can serve up a pleasant memory to him because he immediately, instantly contaminates it. However pleasant the original experience in itself was. This is a serious situation, the ship decided. The man is already showing signs of psychosis, and we are hardly into the trip. Years lie ahead of him. After allowing itself time to think the situation through, the ship decided to contact Victor Cummings once more. Mr. Cummings, the ship said. I'm sorry, Cummings said. I didn't mean to foul up those retrievals. I mean, you did a good job, but I... Just a moment, the ship said. I'm not equipped to do psychiatric reconstruction of you. I am, after all, a simple mechanism. That is all. What is it you want? Where do you want to be? And what do you want to be doing? I want to arrive at our destination. I want this trip to be over. Aha, the ship thought. That is the solution. One by one, the cryonic systems shut down. One by one, the people returned to life. Among them, Victor Cummings. What amazed him was the lack of a sense of the passage of time. He had entered the chamber, lain down, had felt the membrane cover him, and the temperature begin to drop. And now he stood on the ship's external platform, the unloading platform, gazing down at a verdant planetary landscape. This, he realized, is LR-46, the colony world to which I have come in order to begin a new life. Looks good. A heavy-set woman beside him said. Yes, he said, and felt the newness of the landscape rush up at him, the promise of a beginning. Something better than he had known the past 200 years. I am a fresh person in a fresh world, he thought, and he felt glad. Colors raced at him, those of child's semi-animate kit. St. Elmo's fire, he realized. Oh, that's right. There's a lot of ionization in this planet's atmosphere. A free light show, like they had back in the 20th century. Mr. Cummings, a voice said. An elderly man had come up beside him to speak to him. Did you dream? During the suspension, Cummings said. No, not that I can remember. I think I dreamed. Would you take my arm on the descent ramp? I feel a little unsteady. The air seems thin. Do you find it thin? Don't be afraid. Cummings said to him. He took the elderly man's arm. I'll help you down the ramp. Look, There's a guide coming this way. He'll arrange our processing for us. It's part of the package. We'll be taken to a resort hotel and given first-class accommodations. Read your brochure. He smiled at the uneasy older man to reassure him. You'd think that our muscles would be nothing but flab after 10 years in suspension, the elderly man said. Well, it's just like freezing peas, Cummings said. Holding on to the timid older man, he descended the ramp to the ground. You can store them forever if you get them cold enough. Ah, my name is Shelton, the elderly man said.
What?
Cummings said, halting. A strange feeling moved through him. Don Shelton! The elderly man extended his hand reflexively. Cummings accepted it and they shook. What's the matter, Mr. Cummings? Are you all right?
Sure, I'm fine, but hungry. I'd like to get something to eat. I'd like to get to our hotel where I can find a shower, take a shower, change my clothes.
He wondered where their baggage could be found. Probably it would take the ship an hour to unload it. The ship was not particularly intelligent. In an intimate, confidential tone, elderly Mr. Shelton said, You know what I brought with me? A bottle of wild turkey bourbon. The finest bourbon on earth. I'll bring it over to our hotel room, and we'll share it, eh? He nudged Cummings.
I don't drink, Cummings said. Only wine.
He wondered if there were any good wines here in this distant colony world.
Not distant now, he reflected. It's Earth that's distant. I should have done like Mr. Shelton and brought a few bottles with me.
Shelton. What did that name remind him of? Something in his far past, in his early years, something precious, along with good wine and a pretty, gentle young woman making crepes in an old-fashioned kitchen. Aching memories that hurt. Presently, he stood by the bed in his hotel room, his suitcase open. He had begun to hang up his clothes. In the corner of the room, a TV hologram showed a newscaster. He ignored it, but, liking the sound of a human voice, he kept it on. Did I have any dreams, he thought, during those past 10 years? His hand hurt. Gazing down, he saw a red welt as if he had been stung. A bee stung me. When? How, while I lay in cryonic suspension? Impossible. Yet he could see the welt, and he could feel the pain. I'd better get something to put on it, he realized. There's undoubtedly a robot doctor in the hotel. It's a first-rate hotel. When the robot doctor had arrived and was treating the bee sting, Cummings said, I got this as a punishment for killing the bird.
Really?
The robot doctor said. Everything that ever meant anything to me has been taken away from me, Cummings said. Martine, the poster, my little old house with the wine cellar. We had everything and now it's gone. Martine left me because of the bird that you killed, the robot doctor said.
Yeah, God punished me. He took away all that was precious to me because of my sin. It wasn't Dorky's sin, it was my sin.
But you were just a little boy, the robot doctor said.
How did you know that?
Cummings said. He pulled his hand away from the robot doctor's grasp. Something is wrong. You shouldn't have known that.
Your mother told me.
My mother didn't know. She figured it out. There was no way the cat could have reached the bird without your help.
So all the time I was growing up she knew, but she never said anything.
You can forget about it, the robot doctor said. Cummings said,
I don't think you exist. There is no possible way that you could know these things. I'm still in cryonic suspension, and the ship is still feeding me my own buried memory, so I won't become psychotic from sensory deprivation.
You could hardly have a memory of completing the trip.
Well, wish fulfillment, then. It's the same thing. I'll prove it to you. Do you have a screwdriver?
Why?
I'll remove the back of the TV set, and you'll see. There's nothing inside of it. No components, no parts, no chassis, nothing.
I do not have a screwdriver.
A small knife, then. I can see one in your surgical supply bag.
Bending Cummings picked up a small scalpel.
This will do. If I show you, will you believe me?
And if there's nothing inside the TV cabinet? Squatting down, Cummings removed the screws holding the back panel of the TV set in place. The panel came loose, and he set it down on the floor. And there was nothing inside the TV cabinet. And yet the color hologram continued to fill a quarter of the hotel room. The voice of the newscaster continued to issue forth from his three-dimensional image. "Admit you are the ship," Cummings said to the robot doctor.
"Oh, dear,"
the robot doctor said. "Oh, dear," the ship said to itself. "I've got almost 10 years of this lying ahead of me. He is hopelessly contaminating his experiences with childhood guilt. He imagines that his wife left him because when he was 4 years old, he helped a cat catch a bird. The only solution would be for Martine to return to him. But how am I going to arrange that? She may not still be alive." On the other hand, the ship reflected, maybe she is alive. Maybe she could be induced to do something to save her husband's sanity, her former husband's sanity. People, by and large, have positive traits. And 10 years from now, it'll take a lot to save, or rather, restore his sanity. It'll take something drastic, something I myself cannot do alone. Meanwhile, there was nothing to be done but recycle the wish-fulfillment arrival of the ship at its destination. "I'll run him through the arrival," the ship decided, "then wipe his conscious memory clean and run him through it again. The only positive aspect of it," it reflected, "is that it'll give me something to do, which may help preserve my sanity." Lying in cryonic suspension, faulty cryonic suspension, Victor Cummings imagined, once again, that the ship was touching down and he was being brought back to consciousness. "Did you dream?" a heavy-set woman asked him as the group of passengers gathered on the outer platform. "I have the impression that I dreamed. Early scenes of my life, over a century ago." "None that I can remember," Cummings said. He was eager to reach his hotel. A shower and a change of clothes would do wonders for his morale. He felt slightly depressed and wondered why. "Ah, there's our guide," an elderly lady said. "They're going to escort us to our accommodations." "It's in the package," Cummings said. His depression remained. The other seemed so spirited, so full of life, but over him only a weariness lay, a weighing down sensation as if the gravity of this colony planet were too much for him. "Maybe that's it," he said to himself. But according to the brochure, the gravity here matched Earth's. That was one of the attractions. Puzzled, he made his way slowly down the ramp, step by step, holding onto the rail. "I don't really deserve a new chance at life anyhow," he realized. "I'm just going through the motions. I'm not like these other people. There's something wrong with me. I can't remember what it is, but nevertheless, it is there. In me, a bitter sense of pain or lack of worth." An insect landed on the back of Cummings' right hand. An old insect, weary with flight. He halted, watched it crawl across his knuckles. "I could crush it," he thought. "It's so obviously infirm it won't live much longer anyhow." He crushed it and felt great inner horror. "What have I done?" he asked himself. "My first moment here, and I've wiped out a little life. Is this my new beginning?" Turning, he gazed back up at the ship. "Maybe I ought to go back. Have them freeze me forever. I am a man of guilt, a man who destroys." Tears filled his eyes. And within its sentient works, the interstellar ship moaned. During the 10 long years remaining in the trip to the LR-4 system, the ship had plenty of time to track down Martine Cummings. It explained the situation to her. She had emigrated to a vast orbiting dome in the Sirius system, found her situation unsatisfactory, and was en route back to Earth. Roused from her own cryonic suspension, she listened intently, and then agreed to be at the Colony World LR-46 when her ex-husband arrived, if it was at all possible. Fortunately, it was possible. "I don't think he'll recognize me," Martine said to the ship. "I've allowed myself to age. I don't really approve of entirely halting the aging process." He'll be lucky if he recognizes anything, the ship thought. At the inter-system spaceport in the colony world of LR-46, Martin stood waiting for the people aboard the ship to appear on the outer platform. She wondered if she would recognize her former husband. She was a little afraid, but she was glad she had gotten to LR-46 in time. It had been close. Another week and his ship would have arrived before hers. Luck is on my side, she said to herself, and scrutinized the newly landed interstellar ship. People appeared on the platform. She saw him. Victor had changed very little. As he came down the ramp, holding onto the rail as if weary and hesitant, she came up to him, her hands thrust deep in the pockets of her coat. She felt shy, and when she spoke, she could hardly hear her own voice. "Hi, Victor," she managed to say. He halted, gazed at her. "I know you." "It's Martin," she said. Holding out his hand, he said, smiling, "You heard about the trouble in the ship?" "The ship contacted me." She took his hand and held it. "What an ordeal! Oh, my God, yes. Recirculating memories forever. Did I ever tell you about a bee that I was trying to extricate from a spider's web when I was 4 years old? The idiotic bee stung me." He bent down and kissed her. "It's good to see you." "Did the ship, it said, would try to have you here, but it wasn't sure if you could make it." As they walked towards the terminal building, Martin said, "I was lucky. I managed to get a transfer to a military vehicle, a high-velocity drive ship that just shot along like a mad thing, a new propulsion system entirely." Victor Cummings said, "I have spent more time in my own unconscious mind than any other human in history. Worse than early 20th century psychoanalysis and the same material over and over again. Did you know I was scared of my mother?" "Ha! I was scared of your mother," Martin said. They stood at the baggage depot waiting for his luggage to appear. "This looks like a really nice little planet. Much better where I was. I haven't really been happy at all." "So, maybe there's a cosmic plan," he said, grinning. "You look great." "I'm old." "Well, medical science, that was my decision. I like older people." She surveyed him. "He has been hurt a lot by the cryonic malfunction," she said to herself. "I can see it in his eyes. They look broken." Broken eyes, torn down into pieces by fatigue and defeat. As if his early, buried memories swam up and destroyed him. "But it's over," she thought. "And I did get here in time." At the bar in the terminal building, they sat having a drink. "This old man got me to try Wild Turkey Bourbon," Victor said. "It's an amazing bourbon. He said it's the best on Earth. He brought a bottle with him from..." His voice died into silence. "One of your fellow passengers?" Martin finished. "I guess so," he said. "Well, you can stop thinking of the birds and the bees," Martin said. "Sex?" he said and laughed. "Oh, being stung by a bee, helping a cat catch a bird. That's all past." "That cat," Victor said, "has been dead 182 years. I figured it out while they were bringing us out of suspension. Probably just as well. Dorky. Dorky, the killer cat. Nothing like Fat Freddy's cat." "I had to sell the poster," Martin said, finally. He frowned. "You remember? You let me have it when we split up, which I always thought was so good of you. How much did you get for it?" "Oh, a lot. I should pay you something like, let's see, taking inflation into account, I should pay you about $2 million. He said, "Would you consider, in place of the money, my share of the sale of the poster, spending some time with me until I get used to the planet?" "Yes," she said, and she meant it. Very much.
They finished their drinks and then, with his luggage transported by the robo's space cap, made their way to his hotel room.
"Hmm.
This is a nice room," Martine said, perched on the edge of the bed. "And it has a hologram TV. Turn it on."
"Oh, there's no use turning it on," Victor Cumming said. He stood by the open closet, hanging up his shirts.
"Why not?"
Cumming said, "Well, there's nothing on it."
Going over to the TV set, Martine turned it on.
A hockey game materialized, projected out into the room in full color, and the sound of the game assailed her ears.
"It works fine," she said.
"Yeah, I can prove it to you," he said. "Do you have a small nail file or something? I can unscrew the back plate and show you."
"But I can, look at this." He paused in his work of hanging up his clothes.
"Watch me put my hand through the wall."
He placed the palm of his right hand against the wall.
"You see?"
His hand did not go through the wall because hands don't go through walls. His hand remained pressed against the wall, unmoving.
"And the foundation," he said, "is rotting away."
Martine said, "Come sit by me.
I've lived this often enough now. I've lived this over and over again. I come out of suspension, I walk down the ramp, I get my luggage. Sometimes I have a drink at the bar. Sometimes I come directly to my room. Usually I turn on the TV, and then..."
He came over and held his hand toward her.
"You see where the bee stung me?"
She saw no mark on his hand. She took his hand and held it.
"There is no bee sting," she said. "And then when the robot doctor comes, I borrow a tool from him, take off the back plate of the TV set to prove that it has no chassis, no components in it, and then the ship starts me over again."
"Victor," she said, "look at your hand."
"But this is the first time that you're here, though."
"Sit down," she said.
"Okay." He seated himself on the bed, beside her, but not too close to her.
"Won't you sit closer to me?" she said.
"No, it makes me too sad remembering you. I really loved you. I wish this were real."
Martine said, "I will sit with you until it is real for you."
"I'm going to try reliving the part with the cat," he said, "and this time not pick up the cat and not let it get the bird. If I do that, maybe my life will change so that it turns into something happy, something that is real. My real mistake was separating from here, from you. Here, look, I'm going to put my hand through you."
He placed his hand against her arm. The pressure of his muscles was vigorous. She felt the weight, the physical presence of him against her.
"You see? It goes right through you."
"All this," she said, "because you killed a bird when you were a little boy?"
"No," he said. "All of this because of a failure in the temperature regulating assembly aboard the ship. And I'm not down to the proper temperature. There's just enough warmth left in my brain cells to permit cerebral activity."
He stood up then, stretched, smiled at her.
"Shall we go get some dinner?" he asked.
She said,
"Sorry, I'm not hungry." "Well, I am. I'm going to have some of the local seafood. The brochure says that it's terrific. Oh, come along anyhow. Maybe when you see the food and smell it, you'll change your mind."
Gathering up her coat and purse, she came with him.
"This is a beautiful little planet," he said. "I've explored it dozens of times. I know it thoroughly. We should stop downstairs at the pharmacy for some Bactine, though. It's for my hand. It's beginning to swell, and it hurts like hell."
"It hurts more this time than ever before."
"Do you want me to come back to you?" Martine said.
"Are you serious?"
"Yes," she said.
"I'll stay with you as long as you want." "I agree. We never should have separated."
Victor Cumming said, "The poster is torn."
"What?"
she said.
"We should have framed it," he said. "And we didn't have sense enough to take care of it. Now it's torn.
And the artist is dead."
¶¶
I Hope I Shall Arrive Soon by Philip K. Dick.
Eat your greens, don't forget your beans, and celery, don't forget to bring your fake ID, eat a bunch of these magnificent. With sauerkraut, mm-hmm. Sauerkraut. Eat a grape, a fig, a crumpet too. You'll pump 'em right through.
So, was the top spinning at the end of the story or not? I'm not really sure. But in the case of that one, I'm not sure it matters. If you'd like to call and discuss the work of Philip K. Dick, please feel free to do so. The number here at WBAI is area code 212-209-2900. After this Zappa, we'll talk again. Mr. Green Jeans, one of the classic greats from Uncle Meat by Frank Zappa. There's a few wonderful songs from that album, and that is one of them. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, the program Hour of the Wolf, the name Jim Freund, the author we just heard, Philip K. Dick. Sort of fitting with that story, dead 29 years one day ago. The artist is dead being the end of that story. I mean, just reading that story, the different values of it. Philip K. Dick had a lot of layers, a lot of interesting stuff going on in so many of his stories. And yeah, you can see why it inspired so many people to make so many movies. My question is, so why are so many of those films insipid? It's curious. It's very interesting to note that the films that are the most reminiscent of Philip K. Dick, the ones with the exception of a couple, the ones that really do say, yes, I read my Philip K. Dick, yes, I love him as a writer, actually aren't based on stories that Dick wrote. They take place in Dickesque universes. A good case in point is probably Inception, which I finally, after all of this time, saw. And I'm trying to remember exactly who it was who said, I think it was my brother in an email who said that there was less than meets the eye in Inception. It's a very, very good way of putting it because it is such an eyeful, such a beautiful, fabulous, fantastic movie with so many layers of thought. But when you begin to dissect it, it doesn't fit together. It actually doesn't mean a whole lot. Was I talking about Blade Runner? Oh, sorry. No, I was talking about Inception. And yet, well, I'm not going to get into that argument necessarily this morning. We spent our entire second show in this time slot talking about Blade Runner versus the novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep versus the play, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which I hope will have a future life. I thought it was really well done. And that was true Philip K. Dick. That really, really got the essence of it. Much more so, not that I have seen it, so I probably shouldn't be saying whatever, but I can judge from reviews and buzz and talk. The movie The Adjustment Bureau that opened last week, based on the Phil Dick story, Adjustment Team. You know, probably more than those have in common. The phone number here at WBAI and our levels of reality is 212-209-2900. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Let me take the speakerphone off.
Hello? Okay, good idea.
Yeah.
Although it doesn't sound that bad, I have to say, speakerphone.
Oh, okay, well, don't fly at me too much because it could get to my head, James. Okay. And I hold you totally responsible for that, but hey.
Hey.
Such is life, you know?
Yeah.
Getting on to more pertinent and important things. Have you ever entertained the possibility that perhaps science fiction is not meant for the cinema, and that part of the big appeal of science fiction is that people have vivid imaginations, are into books, and somehow no movie, no matter how great or extraordinary, is ever going to fulfill that at any level or partial level? What
no.
Do you think about that?
No, no, I disagree. I think that great cinema
can
evoke great thinking. And,
right.
And but I think that real care has to go into it. If you take a look at, the cinema of Jean-Luc Godard, certainly films like Alphaville, mm-hmm. one of the science fiction greats, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Kubrick. These are works of great thought, and for that matter, talking of Philip K. Dick, the movies A Scanner Darkly is genius science fiction and pure Philip K. Dick, and for that matter, films that are not necessarily Philip K. Dick, but certainly inspired for his kind of writing, Being John Malkovich. Is a great example of brilliant, fabulous science fiction that fulfills science fiction as well as cinema possibly can, and I think it does a very, very good job of it.
Okay, did you ever stop and think that maybe there are certain types of science fiction that are better suited for cinema and other types that are better left in the books?
Well, I think it's all up to the writer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's also up to, did they do a good job with causing you to suspend your disbelief? In other words, I don't think that all the money of special effects in the world are going to bring you to the place that a good science fiction story should do. Again, Alphaville, an example of a movie with zero budget, did a great job. And for that matter, PBS production of The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin. Low budget, great science fiction, pure Le Guin. So actually,
right.
No.
But of course, at the end of the day, good job is in the realm of subjectivity. So, you know.
Yeah, but
good jobs in the first disaster.
I mean, what you're talking about are adaptations. And by the way, another great movie of speculative fiction, the movie Adaptation, which by no small coincidence is written by the same guy who wrote Being John Malkovich. So, but
so you're
but,
saying the adaptations have a better chance of ringing true than literal direct.
No, I didn't say that at all. You asked if there was an area of science fiction or if science fiction shouldn't be done in cinema.
Right.
To which I say, no, that's not true. It just needs to be done well.
Right.
No, I'm not rating it over anything else. What I am saying, I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, that's like saying, do you think that people shouldn't write things down in books because telling the story is so much better?
No, I'm not living in that literal world. I'm just saying when I say should or shouldn't, I'm not working the absolutist conjecture paradigm here. I'm just saying that it just seems a lot of the stuff that gets eventually done as science fiction in films, a lot of people don't like.
Well, because they're bad films.
Right, but at the end of the day, bad and good is their own subjectivity. So you know,
yeah, only to an extent. Only to an extent. You can't, you know,
yeah.
Somebody who goes out and does Robot Monster 20,000 AD in the 1950s is not putting the same kind of thought and care into Inception. There's good cinema and there's bad cinema.
You don't like Rocket's Jaw on Strings and that kind of low-tech stuff? Or
No, I don't. And even if I do, I do it because I really like what I have been partaking beforehand.
Right.
I also like junky novels and junky short stories, but I accept them for what it is. I enjoy junky movies.
Right.
But there does come a time when you can take a look at something and say, you know what, it ain't just me. This is just a bad film.
Right, and then enough people have a consensus that you can say, okay, yeah, I'm not living in delusion. There is some reality here that can be seen through the eyes of others, and there's something going on here that's maybe not as good as it could be.
Yeah, I mean, very simply, if somebody is walking to the left and they say something and they cut back, and all of a sudden that person is walking to the right, this is bad continuity.
Right.
It's not a thoughtful thing. It's a cheap thing. It's a bad movie. It doesn't matter whether it's a mystery, a comedy show.
Sure.
It doesn't matter. It's a bad movie. It was badly constructed, poorly made. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
And, science fiction sells. Nowadays, it's comics sell even bigger than science fiction, which is to say cheap science fiction sells.
Right.
But from the very, very day that cinema was invented and created in France, you get the magicians like Georges Méliès creating great science fiction films based on Jules Verne.
Right. Let me ask you,
the beginning of cinema is science fiction stories.
Yeah, let me ask you just one last thing. Do you think that the pushing up of that cheap stuff is helping the good stuff to rise and get noticed?
No.
No?
No, I don't think so at all. In fact, much the opposite. I think that cheap bad stuff, like economics, the bad stuff pushes the good stuff out of the market.
Well, I think the bad stuff coming up is at least the curiosity seekers, the people who are serious seekers of science fiction, are at least going to be curious. And maybe that all that stuff coming up will draw some kind of curiosity quotient and make people look for a little good stuff.
No, I think that junk creates more junk.
More junk?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that really, and unfortunately, good stuff creates junk also. Something good can be made, and all of a sudden you get all these imitators. I don't know. And again, I don't think that Inception was a great movie. I thought that it had merit. But, you know, how many variants on Avatar are we going to see in the next few years? And Avatar, while an amazing roller coaster ride and a fabulous experience, is not deep, well-written science fiction. It just isn't. It's an amazing experience. But, for science fiction, it's the oldest tropes in the world and didn't do a whole much for the literature. So what's going to happen as a result? You're going to see bad imitations. So you come out with a really great movie that makes you feel like an 8-year-old again. Let's call it Star Wars. What comes as a result of that? Battlestar Galactica, the original.
So is this like special effects fetishism here on some level?
Yes, some of it is just special effect fetishes. And I like, by the way, special effect fetishes.
Sure.
I have one. I've got no problem going to see a movie and Inception, by the way, is certainly one of them. You know, there, it's like, you know, no matter what, we'll always have The Folding of Paris. that's an amazing moment in cinema that will always be there. But when you, and maybe, by the way, that will propel somebody to write a story that works well.
Or the last rendition of War of the Worlds, you know, bombing of the Bayonne Bridge. Let's not leave that out, you know?
That was an incredible image. And that actually was a very well-done science fiction film from beginning to end. I thought it was quite decent. I thought it was, as far as film is concerned, it's the best adaptation, even though it takes so many liberties. But it's a very good adaptation. And, by the way, has much more from the novel in it than the Gene Barry movie.
Right. Nobody's going to try to do a literal extraction of a novel because it's chronologically dated.
Well, you don't want to do an extraction going into another medium. You must adapt for the medium in which you're working.
No, and besides that, it was written so many years ago that you just, who's going to watch something that's based on...
Well, that's now I'll argue with you on that. There was on the BBC not that long ago. It hasn't been broadcast in the United States yet. Speaking of H.G. Wells, From the Earth to the Moon, a new production written by and starring Mark Gatiss, and it
faithful to the novel,
extremely, totally. Cavorite the whole bit.
Well, that's BBC. That's different from, like...
I don't care who did it.
No, I understand that.
The point is that it was done and that it was faithful.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about who made it. We're talking about the capability of its being done.
Right. No, I'm talking about our artistic integrity is different from the economic, exigencies of, making a movie for the theaters.
Well, not necessarily. Yeah. The BBC is government run, but they are under terrible, terrible financial constraint. And they're pulling back on so much stuff. They're not, from what I understand, Film 4 isn't producing more films, even though they recently did something called The King's Speech.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. but you see, that's the point. And by the way, there are good American films and even occasionally good American television out there, although not often.
Not too much, yeah.
But, there's some.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, great talking to you, all right? I'll
take care.
Flat here. Take care, now.
Okay, bye-bye. All righty, well, I sort of feel back in the saddle again. It's like been a month since I've seen Lister, and it's so wonderful to see him here. The marathon was like this netherworld, perhaps this necessary netherworld, but we were a bit in suspended animation for a while there, and now I feel like we're back.
Finally,
indeed. And let's hope that for another 3 or 4 months.
Did they make the gold?
I guess so. I believe they did. They extended the thon till yesterday, till the 28th.
Great.
And I saw a tally of 864. I think the goal was supposed to be 800,000. So, well, yeah, but you see, now I say yeah, not because we didn't do well, because the next part is up to the listeners. Now all of you have pledged. Now it's fulfillment time. And fulfillment time is if you pledged, you better pay. When you get that pledge for problems that we have faced in the past are that we've made goals but didn't get the money.
Otherwise, we get the retired census takers to knock on the doors and say, "Hey, cough it up."
Retired census takers. I want the hit. I want the hit guys to come and hit your door and put a little mark on it and say, you know, every time you don't fulfill this, we're going to put a little, you know, I voted for the Tea Party sticker on your door, and your neighbors are really going to think the worst of you.
I heard Gaddafi recruited the Tea Party.
Yeah, well, the Tea Party are libertarians, and Gaddafi, God knows what he is. He is such a horrible
joke, right?
Yeah. He is a horrible joke. But he's a horrible joke that has lasted for years and years and years. You know, much too long. You know, Libya and Haiti and, you know, what is the political future? Well, I'm one of the worst political people in the world.
Why?
Why? Because I don't get it. I don't grasp it. It's not that I am, you know, when I say worse, I don't mean I like the wrong things. I mean, it goes over my head. And so I deal with politics in the big, big good versus bad, rather than this person or versus that country. I am both very skeptical of things that I hear my comrades on this radio station say, and I am certainly skeptical of the things that our great leaders tell us. I'm mostly skeptical of the media, which of course we are a part of. So, you know, you can't get much more self-cynical than that.
What happened if you stood on a box? You think it would hit you in your head?
I think that has happened more than a couple of times, yeah. I've certainly made decisions in the past, political decisions, that in retrospect I just thought, wow, that was bizarre. Or not, and sometimes it wasn't even that it was bizarre, because my thinking at the time fit what I knew at the time, but I didn't perceive what my political betters, many of them here at WBAI, perceived. And other times I've taken a look at things and said, no, it's not like that, it's like this. And everybody gainsaid me, and I, darn it, was right. I'm, you know, so if you want politics from me, better to ask me about a PC versus a Mac than a politician versus another politician.
We're talking about a Mac. The recycled Mac that they're putting out, what do you think of it now?
The recycled Mac?
Yeah, they're putting out, you know, that flat, thin, very thin.
I mean the tablets, the iPads?
I call it the pill, you call it the tablet.
Well, they're called tablets, yeah.
Okay, I call it the pill.
Okay, well, if I want, oh my God, I've got 1 minute left. If I want a tablet, I will, personally, I will wait for an Android tablet and not an Apple tablet. There's already the Motorola Zoom, but it's vastly overpriced.
Yes.
But within the next 3 months, we're going to see over 30 competing tablets to the iPad. Mm-hmm. So, like with a phone, I waited and I got myself an Android phone. And with a tablet, I'll wait and get myself an open source Android tablet that I can use with anybody, where nobody tells me what software I can or cannot put on it, which is what Apple tells people to do. I don't care for the walled garden. So, no iPad for me, sorry. No Kindle. I'll get an Android tablet. Not soon. I'm going to let other people do the testing.
Well, I'm just like you.
But, ooh. I have to start my outro theme, and I still have to remind people about my next event. Because it is this Sunday at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Andrea Hairston, a wonderful, wonderful weaver of fantasy and thought, black writer. Since you're on the radio, we have to say that kind of thing. But she'll be performing with Pan Morgan, who is an amazing musician. Really lovely, bizarre, bizarre in the sense that it's just so amazingly original and multicultural, just like Andrea's writing. And the two of them will be performing at 138 Sullivan Street this Sunday, March 6th at 2 o'clock. Admission is free, although I will be at the door asking you to lend a donation to help pay gas, and because they're driving down from Massachusetts. And for more information, visit ourwolf.com, OurWolf. You'll see the link for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and take a look at that, and that'll give you all the information. But you must now stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers. Howling your way over these same airwaves. Thank goodness the thon is over. Pay your pledge. Stay tuned to WBAI. My guest next week, Gordon Van Gelder, the publisher and editor of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, and he has a new book out, which is the reason why he's coming. But Gordon's one of the most important people today in science fiction. So tune in. You'll have fun. Good morning. Take care.
Out of system!
Burn it!
Revolutionary war is a necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
Baby, burn! I can see the light.